1941, I was 11 years old. We lived in the town of Kodiak, about where Sutliff's hardware store is now, right beside what is now the Boat Harbor. Except there was no Boat Harbor here in those days. Kodiak was a salmon fishing village prior to World War II, and the area that is now referred to as the city dock, where the processing plants are, like APS and such, those buildings originally were a cannery operated by Kodiak Fisheries Company. And then once the war started, the Army took over that facility because it had a dock, and the Army needed a dock to land its freighters, their ships that brought in the materials of war. And so they just simply commandeered that dock. And the fishermen in Kodiak were all salmon fishermen, and they had small boats compared to what they use today. In fact, a lot of fishermen fished out of dories in those days. And the dories would have one-cylinder gas engines in them, and then they'd tow a bigger skiff that would have the net, and they'd carry the fish in both boats. I guess the word that would describe Kodiak prior to World War II would be pastoral. It was very active in the summertime, and then in the fall the village life would just quiet down and be almost nothing happening in Kodiak during the winter months between the salmon fishing seasons. And now, some of my memories of that period was seeing things like the salmon boats anchored, salmon dories really, anchored out in front of the village of Kodiak, in that area that is now the small boat harbor. And I can remember seeing whales coming up and blowing and swimming real lazy-like right in amongst the dories that were anchored there. And then, of course, there was a fish cannery down at what in those days was called Erskine's Dock, run by Frank McConaughey, and that was called McConaughey's Cannery. And from today's interests, the canneries in those days had what they called gurry scows, and they would haul the fish wastes, the heads, the entrails, and such. They'd take that out and dump it in Woody Island Channel or further out. So there was no need for a company like BioDry or an operation like BioDry, because the waste was taken out and dumped. That fed other fish. It was a very beautiful little town back in those days. And the winter time, they would put a lot of effort into celebrating things like Thanksgiving, Christmas, and then Russian Christmas and New Year's, and then Russian New Year's. And probably that was the highest point of social life in Kodiak, was the celebration of Russian New Year's and Russian Christmas, because the Russian church in those days was more or less the cultural center of the town, of the village. And there were activities like starring, where the people would create these magnificent stars which was really a wooden framework, and then highly decorated so that it reflected a lot of light. They put bright ribbons and things that would reflect like glass and such into it. And they'd go from house to house, and they would stand there and twirl that star. And then they would sing carols in English and in Russian. We had two people in Kodiak who, after the war started, became what we called enemy aliens. One was a German, and his name was Erich Mueller, and he worked for Louis Thompson, who owned a Teamster operation, where with his team of big black dray horses would do any moving that had to be done in town with horse and wagon. These two great big horses, one was named Dolly, and the other one, this is how things change, the other one's name was Nigger. And Erich Mueller worked for him, and then eventually they bought a truck, and then they would deliver oil from Standard Oil Company, which was down on Erskine's dock, and they would deliver oil to the houses of the community that burned oil. Most of the houses in the community burned coal or wood, but some of them were modernizing, and they would use oil. And when the war started, then because he was not an American citizen, he hadn't been naturalized yet, he wasn't an American citizen. And so he was deported, not deported, but he was shipped off to a concentration camp. And then the other person we had in the village was a dear old man called Martin. I can't remember what Martin's last name was, but everybody in those days knew him as Martin the Jap. And here he was, an old man, couldn't hurt a fly. And he was shipped off to the concentration camps that all of the Japanese in America were sent to. In Arizona, and he didn't survive. He never made it back to Kodiak, but Erich Mueller did. And then he took Thompson transfer from Louis Thompson's days. And I remember old Louis had an accident where his horses stampeded on him. They ran a runaway team, and he was snagged in the harnesses, and they drug him for quite a distance on the gravel road, and ripped one of his eyes out on the rocks. And so, and then, you know, his body was pretty badly bruised up also, to the point that he could no longer work as he had before. And Erich took over from him in that job, and worked as the Teamster, and then as the truck driver, and then eventually, I guess he bought the company from Louis, I would assume, and turned it into what is now called Thompson Transfer, and is kind of a a mainstay of Kodiak. But the dances that were held in the New Year's period, the Russian Christmas and Russian New Year's, were usually masquerade balls, and they were held in a hall that was called Glenn's Hall, and it was next to what had previously been the B&B Bar. Eventually became the B&B Bar, but of course it was Glenn's Bar back in those days. And it was the usual thing to have people come to the dances all made up in masquerade, and everybody would try to keep everyone else from identifying them. And I can remember that there were, oh, for instance, Edna Hester came to the dance dressed as a clown, and she was doing acrobatic dances, things that we never ever dreamed that that Edna could do, and nobody could guess who in the world is that, you know. But there was a lot of fun, just a lot of fun. And there were some fantastic dancers in the village back in those days, because dancing was one of the favorite outlets, the favorite social situations, where people would make their own music. Somebody would pick up a guitar, somebody would pick up an accordion, somebody would pick up a saxophone, and somebody would sit at the piano, and they just provide the music for everybody else to enjoy and to dance to. And then, of course, there were the church services. And it was just taken as a given that on these various occasions, and especially at Easter time, that the bells of the Russian church would ring out over the community. And, of course, the community was very quiet, so those sounds carried quite a long ways. And I remember there was this one man who rang the bells. His name was Cachevera, his last name, and he could really make music with those bells. What else is noteworthy about? Oh, the community was supplied by the Alaska Steamship Company. And we would get maybe one boat a month. And so it was a very exciting thing when the ship would arrive. And in those days, the ship's names were things like Carso, Star, Lackinac, Cordova, Yukon, Denali. All these ships have long since disappeared. In fact, America has very little shipping of that type anymore, anywhere. And everybody's life revolved around the fishing in summertime. And I remember that people would charge their groceries at Kraft's store, and Kraft's store would function not only as a grocery store, but a mercantile store where all the equipment you needed, all the clothing you needed to live in Kodiak, they handled, as was also the case with the W.J. Erskine Company. The W.J. Erskine Company was the company that was the successor to the Alaska Commercial Company, the original Russian company store. Besides being a hardware store, mercantile store, clothing store, grocery store, Kraft also functioned as a bank, because that was the only safe in town. So people would get their settlements after fishing, and they just take their money and hand it to Ben Kraft and ask him, here, you know, take what you need to cover what I've charged, and, you know, then the rest of it will go to cover part of what we'll charge this winter. And Ben would carry a lot of people. Sometimes there wouldn't be enough money made in the fishing season to cover the bill, but he'd still carry them. Nobody would go hungry. And that kind of characterized the community back in those days, where we were all up against the problem of surviving, and so everybody helped everybody. I can remember that when the fishing seasons were on, if somebody went out and got a half a dozen halibut, they'd come in, land their boat, And if somebody wanted halibut, they'd come down and ask, you know, could we have some of the halibut? The response would always be, certainly, take it. You know? And the same thing with salmon. The same thing with halibut, I always said that. Codfish. Back in those days, there was quite a bit of codfish around. People used it a lot as food. And one of the interesting things from my standpoint is that when there was a lot of codfish around here, there was no king crab. But then after the codfish disappeared, then the king crab showed up. And of course, king crab is post-World War II. It was in the late 40s that king crab became a marketable product from this area. Let's see, what else would there be about Kodiak? Yeah, I just was reminded that W.J. Erskine Company also would function as a bank. I was mentioning that Kraft would let people put their envelopes of money in the store's safe. And I was thinking in terms of that was the only safe around, but that's not true. Erskine's also had a big safe, and they would provide that same service. Except that people didn't trust Erskine's way that they did Kraft. because if Fugan got ripped off, Fugan got cheated. Yeah, right. Yeah, human nature is no different than it is today. let's see. What else was there about the town of Kodiak? Right. Probably the natural bridge in World War II would be the mention of the arrival of the Navy. There were a squadron of PBYs that came into Kodiak in 1939, and in my mind's eye, I can still see them coming in. They flew in formation, in a stair-step formation, one above and behind the other. And they landed, and a seaplane tender had arrived a few days prior to their arrival, and had set out mooring buoys. In those days, they were truly seaplanes. They landed on the water and they stayed on the water. They didn't come out of the water the way that seaplanes do today. Now they have amphibians that can land on water but come out of the water. But in those days, the planes had to land on the bay and then stay there. And one of the pilots of those PBYs I met after the war, way in the early 60s, and he was still in the Navy, and he was telling me that when he came into Kodiak in a subsequent flight, but in that same time frame, that the fog came in and he couldn't see to land where they were supposed to land. And so he had to land out in Chiniac Bay and then taxi all the way into Kodiak. And that was scary enough for him because, of course, the water is not smoothed out as you get out of the bay out of St. Paul Harbor. And your chances of surviving a landing in that kind of water is about 50%. About half of the planes that attempt to land on rough water don't make it. And so then he told me that that episode, that incident, had convinced him that he should stick with the Fleet Navy, not with the Air Arm of the Navy. And at that time that I was talking with him, he was the commander Pacific Fleet, so he apparently did pretty well in the Black Shoe Navy. in the Navy, the flyers wear brown uniforms, brown shoes, and the Fleet sailors wear black shoes and black uniforms. Or, not black, but navy. Navy blue. So, these PBYs arrived, and it was the advance party to check out the possibility of building a Navy base in Kodiak. President Roosevelt had ordered the construction of a number of bases all over the world, actually. They called them destroyer bases because they needed a place for warships to store supplies, ammunition, fuel, that sort of thing, food. And that's what Kodiak was supposed to be, is one of these bases that were being built for resupply of warships, because they anticipated that there would be a problem with Japan. And so they looked at the map and decided that Kodiak was in a very strategic location for controlling the North Pacific Ocean. And so then the Navy hired a construction company called Simstrate Puget Sound Construction Company to come in and start doing the work to build the base here. Prior to that, about the only thing you'd find in that area was a few cattle and bears. It was really way out of town and very remote. And shortly after that work began, then the war started. And so then there was a real crash program to get that base built. It changed the life in Kodiak completely, absolutely different community altogether, because suddenly Kodiak was a boom town, and the population exploded. There was no housing. People were throwing up tar paper shacks any place they could, and it was very complex because the United States had bought the Tsar out in Alaska, and that happened in 1867, and it was 1912 before the United States government started coming into Alaska. And there's no way that they had provided services like town site survey. So in the old days, nobody claimed land the way that is done today. If somebody needed to build a house, they'd ask the people that they'd be neighbors to, is it okay if I build a house over here? And generally the person would say, well, sure, go ahead. And all of a sudden there were just scads of people building tar paper shacks, building houses, building tents. For instance, my mother's sister, Betty, came to Kodiak, and all the time that she was here, she lived in a tent, and they were very comfortable. They were, you know, very satisfied with that life. They lived here for years, and tents just popped up all over the place. And, of course, people that came in were hardworking and hard drinking, and the town just absolutely boomed. During the war, Tony's Bar was famous. That's the operation that they now call Tony's, but it was not in that location. It was kind of out where Kraft's parking lot is now, parking lot in front of Kraft's. And it was advertised as the longest bar in Alaska. And when these civilian workers plus the military would be on leave, they'd be in that bar, and they might be 8 or 10 people deep at the bar. And all that the bartenders would do is open bottles of beer and pour shots of whiskey. And they would report to work with a number 3 wash tub and a baseball bat. And they never rang up any of the sales. They just push out the beer, get the money, throw it in that wash tub. And the baseball bat was handy for foiling any attempt at robbery, because it was a wild place back in those days. A lot of the people that were up here in those days were fringe type people. They weren't used to being living by the rules of society. That's right. And from a sleepy little town where they might have sold a keg of beer a week, it just boomed into a place where whole shiploads would come into Kodiak with nothing but beer, practically. I worked on the docks during that time, and we might have, if we had 1,000 tons of freight come in, about 200 tons of it would be food and supplies, that sort of thing, and 800 tons would be beer. No, the Alaska Steamship Company could pretty well keep up with supplying the food that was needed. Plus, once the big push was on to build the base, then the Navy started hauling in the food and everything that they needed. And there was always a synergistic relationship between the base and the town in those days. If the town needed a service that was available on the base that wasn't available in town, the base would supply it. Like, for instance, my first pair of eyeglasses I got from the Navy dispensary in on the base, because there were no eye doctors in Kodiak. That sort of thing. There wasn't any contention between the town and the base back in those days. Later, that sort of thing developed. But during the war, everybody's attention was focused on getting ready to fight the Japs. You notice I said Japs, not Japanese. Because in World War II, you referred to those dirty, slimy Japs. You didn't call them the Japanese. Oh yes, one of the first things that happened with the startup of the war was that all civilian dependents of the military and of the civilian workers who were accompanying up here in Alaska were immediately shipped out back to the States. And a woman could be up here if she was single, but if she was married to a serviceman, she had to leave. And I remember there was one soldier from Fort Greeley who used to, his wife pretended to be single, but she had a house in town, and every chance he got, he would, whether he had a pass or not, he would sneak into town, and even to the point where he would swim across the mouth of Gibson Bay in order to walk the beach to get into town. What was that guy's name? DeYoung? DeYoung? Kim DeYoung? Yeah, right. But those of us who were in the civilian community were not shipped out. They let us stay here. However, out in the Aleutians, they did relocate a lot of people from the Aleutian Islands down to Southeast Alaska. And in fact, when I was in Southeast Alaska, particularly in Juneau and Sitka, I was always meeting people who had been relocated during the war, and they never ever made it back to their homes in the Aleutians. And then the people who were on on Attu Island when the Japanese invaded it, were interned in prisoner of war camps in Japan. It was essentially an Aleut population. And then there were two white people on the island, the Joneses. They were school teachers. They were also interned in Japan in prisoner of war camps. As the military buildup came, it restricted our movement. I remember there was a line, an imaginary line drawn from the beach down just short of the city dock out to that red buoy that's out in the harbor. And you couldn't go past that line. If you did, the army would send a boat out and get you and take you back. And if, like those of us who were young and would go fishing in the trout streams and lakes and that sort of thing, it was really dangerous because there were armed sentries everywhere. And if you stumbled into a place that you weren't supposed to be, it could be disastrous. We had one incident where kid and I got lost in the fog, and the first thing we knew, we were walking into a machine gun nest, and it's just lucky that the guys were willing to wait and see who we were before they started shooting. And let's see. Favorite things to do was to carve little sailboats, and if the wind was blowing northeast, I would take and launch this boat with paper sail, this sort of thing, and it would blow toward the base. And I found out later, or my dad found out later, that the army was investigating me because they wanted to know if I was some kind of a spy that was sending messages by these. And let's see, how else did it affect this? Well, for one thing, everywhere in the country there was food rationing. So you could only buy certain amounts of food at a time, depending on how many people in the family, this sort of thing. But that restriction was considerably relaxed for Alaskans later. And we didn't have the really tight restrictions on the food we could purchase the way people in the lower 48 did, because our supply could be cut off just at any time by Japanese interdiction. There was only one incident where we thought we were going to have to use our air raid shelters. Everybody was required to dig a trench and have it ready in case of an air raid, and it was a place to get in out of the danger zone. And this one time, there was an American squadron of Army aircraft, Army Air Corps, coming in, and they forgot to turn on their little radio that identifies them. They called it an IFF cam, identification friend or foe. And they detected these planes approaching, aircraft warning detachment. And there was no radio signal identifying them, so they hit the air raid warnings. And everybody ran for their shelters, and then we sat and waited to see what was going to happen. And I remember that everybody had to decide real quick what they were going to take with them when they went to the trenches, because you never knew if your homes were wiped out in a bombing raid, that sort of thing. You wouldn't know what was going to be there when you got back. And it always struck us funny that my mother grabbed nothing but her chime clock. stuck it under her arm and ran up the mountain with it. So, were there any other questions that you had that? Oh, yes. Yeah, right. But the places we could go were very restricted. We couldn't go out to Mill Bay. Or we couldn't go beyond what is now Mill Bay. But there were Coast Artillery units out on Miller Point and Spruce Cape. And they wouldn't let us get close to that. And then, of course, they had built the highway from the base to Cape Chiniac, where they had an additional air strip for fighter planes. They had the Bell Air Cobra fighters stationed out here, plus on the base. And the incident that I was just talking about, where the air raid warning sounded, we weren't aware of how many of these fighter planes were stationed in Kodiak, but we ran up to our trench, and then from there we had a real good view of the base, and we looked out there, and here comes all these fighter planes, like a swarm of bees, and they were taken off from the airstrip, and then they'd circle and gain altitude and go up. Then they vectored out over the ocean in the direction that the planes were coming in. And then, as we were standing there watching, after a little while, all of a sudden here comes a whole bunch of more fighter planes. They had the Lockheed Lightning and the Bell Air Cobra were the main, and the P-40 was the other one that fighter equipment that they had. And all of a sudden, here comes these Lightnings and the Bell Air Cobras from Anchorage. They had sent them down to cover the base while the other fighters were out looking for these aircraft that were coming in, suspected of being Japanese. But it's still a vivid picture in my mind of that swarm of fighters taken up off the base. And that same thing was happening out here at Chiniac, too. Just scores of fighter planes taken off. Then, during that air raid scare, there had been sailors in town on Liberty. And I can remember some sailors standing right beside me, and they were looking out, and they saw their ship going out, setting out to sea, because of course the ships would be better off at sea than they where they could maneuver rather than being in the harbor. And they said, you know, oh, there goes our ship, and they named it. And then many years later, and I remembered the name later, when Nancy Freeman's father came to Kodiak, and we got to talk about, you know, whether he was ever here before, this sort of thing. He said, yeah, I was here during the war. I was on he named this destroyer, and I can still remember that was the destroyer that we watched pulling out, you know. But right at this moment, I can't remember the name of the destroyer. But we had to be very careful. After the troop buildup was complete, there were about 30,000 troops, Navy and Army, in Kodiak area, and the area that is now above B&B Fisheries and Pacific Pearl in that area was the Red Light District. And they had something like 200 girls working in that district. And so there would be flocks of servicemen, sailors, soldiers, and they would drop them off downtown at about where Kraft Supermarket is now. And then they would immediately go down the down the road to the Red Light District. And then they go from there to the bars. And I can remember them going by. We lived about where Sutton's Hardware Store is now. And I can remember these crowds of men going by down to the cat houses. And particularly after the Battle of the Coral Sea and as in the Battle of Midway, one morning we woke up and St. Paul Harbor was full of warships, cruisers, destroyers, transports, freighters, all that sort of thing. And this was the first port of call and the first liberty for the sailors on these ships since the battles. They had participated in the battles of Coral Sea and Midway. And of course, the Battle of Midway was a turning point of World War II in the Pacific. That was a key battle. But I can remember standing in the yard and hearing these drunk sailors going by, and they'd be saying things like, you know, well, you would have messed your pants too if you'd seen that Jap coming right straight at you with his guns firing.